Once upon a time, food and cooking shows were few and far between on TV, and they were mostly how-to instructional programs. While you can still tune in and learn some useful recipes, the world of food TV has expanded a lot over the last decade or so to help feed the growing appetites of curious viewers. And that growth is showing no signs of stopping, with major streaming services like Netflix and Hulu announcing more and more cuisine content to come with each year. Michael O'Connell is a writer for The Hollywood Reporter. He wrote a piece on peak food TV. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, for people who aren't keeping track, can you give us a sense of the scope? How many shows are out there now and still in production?
At the moment, there's a little over 70 food-related shows across platforms, and that's if you ignore the like 5-minute shows that air on YouTube and some of these smaller streaming platforms, of which there are many. But like proper, like half-hour to hour-long shows, there's over 70, and in the next year, there's going to be over 100.
What is it about these food shows that has caught on among TV networks and viewers?
Well, you know what? There are several reasons. I mean, one, like, we cannot underestimate the power of the more is more attitude and approach that the television industry is taking right now, with all these new streaming platforms emerging, it getting so much more competitive, and the linear, like old school networks, there's just more and more offerings for customers. But it's also proven to be this wildly exportable genre. You can air a food show in America that follows a Mexican family in the outskirts of Los Angeles and their culinary traditions. You add subtitles, you can put it anywhere, and people in any country are just as eager to watch the way other countries are cooking. And that isn't the same for a lot of unscripted television, and it isn't the same for a lot of scripted television either.
That's interesting. I've heard that argument for action movies. Action translates really well all over the globe. You just need to throw some subtitles on. TV food shows are a similar genre, apparently.
Yes, unlike rom-coms, which do not translate as well.
So take us back to some of the proto food shows. Who are some of the people who first gave us the idea that, hey, it's fun to watch people cook on the TV?
Well, I mean, Julia Child really was the first major American personality to break through on television. And she started out in I think it was only distributed on Boston Public Television. It ended up being a national program, but she rose to immense celebrity because of her cooking on television. And there were other instances over the years. The Frugal Gourmet comes to mind in the 80s. But it wasn't until the Food Network really hit its stride after about a decade on the air that we started minting dozens of well-known either TV chefs or home cooks who had great personality and could translate to television. But the sort of like dawn of the celebrity chef, I would say, is in the mid-aughts. Because, I mean, up until the 90s, working in food wasn't even a profitable business. Like, no one wanted their children to be chefs.
Another appeal that you wrote about, actually, for a network wanting to produce these things is they don't, unlike food, they don't expire. If I watch a cooking show from 2 years ago, it might be just as relevant to me as one that came out yesterday.
Oh, completely. I mean, tastes change over the years, and there are certain things that aren't as repeatable. But for the most part, especially if you look at these travel logs, where people go to different countries and interview home cooks or farmers or cheesemongers, these things are evergreen and they replay really well. And another sort of argument for them in streamers getting on board with them is the streaming culture on like Netflix and Hulu and these upcoming platforms, it's very different than how cable is operated. On cable, there are a lot of channels where people just sort of like set it and forget it, and it's on. It's background noise. Like, that's how Food Network and HGTV became these multi-billion-dollar brands. But streaming is still like more of a proactive view. You have to go in and you have to select something, and you're always being presented with choices. And these food shows, you can just put them on, and they run and they run and they run, and you like they just keep viewers engaged.
Talking to Michael O'Connell from The Hollywood Reporter. We're talking about peak food TV, 70-ish shows out there now. We're going to hit three digits pretty soon. He says you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you watch cooking shows or shows about restaurants and food? Why? What are your favorites? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Michael, we heard from David on Facebook who says, I really liked Anthony Bourdain's show. I miss him. David's not alone, and the loss of Anthony Bourdain really left a void in the food world, didn't it?
It certainly did. And I mean, he's been gone over a year, and his legacy is well reflected in the recent Emmy nominations. The last few episodes of his show that CNN aired pretty much swept the nonfiction categories in nominations. And it's funny because people recognize that there is that void right now, but people are so sensitive about his legacy that copycats aren't going to emerge for a while. I think people are being very respectful about that. He had a very, very, very unique voice, and a lot of people credit him with this sort of elevation of style of food TV.
Looking at some other big names in food TV, Gordon Ramsay, this guy is all over the place, whether he is actually on the camera, it sounds like, or whether he's behind the scenes producing shows. Can you talk about the Gordon Ramsay industry?
I mean, the Gordon Ramsay industry is huge. Not even including television, he's trying to open 100 restaurants in the United States over the next 5 years. He just got this massive round of funding from a private equity firm. But I mean, he's been a staple on the Fox network since, I believe, 2005, 2006. He occupies over 10% of a primetime schedule on a broadcast network, which is just truly remarkable. And these shows wax and wane. They're not as huge as they used to be, but he's still a force to be reckoned with on that network. And as many people do when they have a taste of success, he's getting into producing and is now going to start making food shows that aren't necessarily vehicles for him because he is quite stretched thin.
And there's a huge variety of shows out there. You write about the prestige ones. I think Anthony Bourdain's travel shows fit that. And a big one that kind of seemed like it came out of nowhere to me, this Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat TV show / book / phenomenon. Can you talk about where that fits in?
Samin Nosrat, who sort of came up at Alice Waters' famous Berkeley restaurant, whose name that I can't remember at the moment, she was sort of just like a chef's chef. People have really respected her for a long time. She had a New York Times Magazine column. She just went on hiatus with it to work on some other stuff, but she's been doing that for years. And she's just been very well liked in that community. And then the book was huge. It won a James Beard Award. It's already in its seventh printing, I think. And she got a Netflix show out of it. And she was just such an eager, refreshing personality for a television show, because she just had no awareness whatsoever of the cameras, and that's really rare.
And then we had this explosion of, I guess, game show type cooking shows, the Chopped, Cutthroat Kitchen. They're competitions. The participants aren't usually celebrities. The judges kind of are. That seems to have a lot of appeal, and it's easy to watch one after another of those.
It is very easy to watch, and that's been the most successful. I mean, when you talk about success in Netflix, it's all anecdotal because we don't really know how their shows rank. But Nailed It has been a big success for them. And that's the show where amateur bakers try to duplicate sort of Instagram-friendly, elaborate desserts to comical results. And that's been a wild hit for them.
Talking to Michael O'Connell, senior writer at The Hollywood Reporter, about the popularity of cooking shows and the explosion of cooking shows out on the market. More to come. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of food TV shows, whether they're about cooking or restaurants or travel and food? What are your favorite programs? What got you hooked in the first place? Are you ever inspired to cook something based on one of those shows? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation with Michael O'Connell, senior writer at The Hollywood Reporter, talking about the rise of food television and what's coming next from the industry. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you watch a cooking TV show? Do you watch lots of cooking TV shows? What's the appeal? Which one really says something to you? Have you learned stuff, or is it just fun to watch other people do it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Rebecca is with us in Madison. Rebecca, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Rebecca?
Well, I love cooking shows. I watch a lot of them. I've seen Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat at least 3 times because there's so much in there. But when you were introducing the segment and that you and your guests were talking about former cooking show stars, I was reminded of and wondered if your guest remembers The Galloping Gourmet from a million years ago when I was a little kid. Whenever it came on, my father loved it. He would grab a pad of paper and pen and write down the recipe.
Wow.
And because, well, there's no internet or, you know, anything like that, and would make elaborate things from Graham Kerr was the cook or the chef. And my father even did this one recipe that he wrote down and followed to the T, making seafood crepes from scratch with the fish base and everything.
Wow.
And we ate dinner at like 11 o'clock that night.
Rebecca, thank you so much for sharing that. My producer tells me Galloping Gourmet was about 1969 to 71. So Michael, I mean, that's a case where, and that makes me think, so people would have to learn and watch and write down the recipe. Food shows can, they could just post the recipe online. They don't need to be as precise, even if they're trying to teach you how to cook.
Oh, yeah. I mean, honestly, like the internet has changed so much of this, but when you think about it, a lot of these cooking shows are basically vehicles for cookbook authors to sell books. That's how Ina Garten got into Food Network. That's how Nigella Lawson got into food programming. They come out with these shorter series every time they have a book to publish, and it totally works. I think that Ina Garten's most recent book was the top-selling cookbook of that year, and she did like a little like 10 episodes for the Food Network for it.
Rebecca, thanks for reminding us of The Galloping Gourmet. We'll go now to Emily with us in West Bend. Emily, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about? Do you watch any cooking shows, Emily?
Oh, well, that's one of my favorite things to watch. And I am one of the many people I know that is addicted to the Great British Baking Show. I absolutely love it. Everything from their wonderful personalities to the different ways that they approach the challenges. And I have learned so much just by watching that show. I was so daunted with anything that was yeasted before. I have now made my own pizza dough.
Fantastic.
Oh,
Emily,
good.
One of the things I hear people like about the Great British Baking Show is, you know, a lot of reality shows, cooking or otherwise, people are really mean to each other. It's much nicer on the British Baking Show, right?
It really is. They're all like good neighbors.
Emily, thank you so much. Michael, I think especially with public radio and public TV fans, the Great British Baking Show is a big hit.
Oh, my gosh. That show is huge. It's huge over there. It's huge over here. And I think a lot of that is due to just the civility between those contestants, which is just not what we're used to seeing on our American reality television.
Emily, thanks so much. I want to share an interesting story from Leslie, who wrote on Facebook. She says, I'm a cancer survivor. For over 12 months, I was unable to eat food and had a feeding tube. And she says, almost everyone who has some type of inability to eat food due to health reasons watches food shows. All the shows, all day and night. It's very common. Seems crazy, but it's true. Leslie says they inspire and give people hope for their future. It's not just the food, the taste, the shopping. It's hope. And Leslie says, whenever I need a happy place or some fun, I know a great food show will never disappoint. I would have never thought of that, Michael, but what an interesting story.
I couldn't watch food television when I'm hungry, so that is quite remarkable. It's the opposite of what you'd expect.
And me too. Leslie, thank you so much for sharing that story with us. Let's go back to our callers now. Tron is with us in Milwaukee. Tron, hi.
Hey, this is Tron. Oh, I love watching the cooking shows. The only hello?
Yep, go ahead, Tron. You're on the air.
Oh, there you are. Oh, I love to watch the cooking shows. But I like all the ingredients and everything else, and some of these are a little bit exotic, you know. But, you know, the thing about it is that when the cooking shows are going, they have all these fancy equipment that some of us don't have. But that's where, if you are like, what's called, when you can actually, oh, I got it right in my face. Oh,
okay. I think we're losing you there, Tron. But Tron was saying they have a lot of fancy equipment, and it's maybe hard for the viewer at home to replicate what they're doing in what's clearly a well set up commercial kitchen, Michael.
I think that a lot of shows are evolving past that, and because they recognize the barrier to entry can be quite significant in kitchens. Not everyone has a Vitamix or a stand mixer. And I think that there are, especially when you go online to like the websites associated with these TV chefs or with the programs, they give you workarounds if they are indeed using something elaborate. But I mean, you don't see a lot of like sous vide-ing happening on these shows.
Tron, thanks a lot for the call. We're talking to Michael O'Connell from The Hollywood Reporter, looking at the rise of cooking shows. Michael, before we go back to callers, you mentioned a bunch of shows coming out, still in production. What are the trends you're watching for in the future when it comes to food TV?
As far as trends, I think it's a lot of moving away from the very standard, we're in a kitchen and we're preparing a meal. There used to be a lot more live studio audience stuff too, and I don't think that we're going to see much of that. It's a lot of road shows and sort of getting stories behind food from the people who cook them, cultural stories, and then showing a way to do that in your own home.
Let's go back to our callers now. Patrice is with us in Horicon. Patrice, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am calling to express my admiration for Nancy Fuller, Farmhouse Rules, and for simple reasons. As Sean was talking about, she doesn't use a lot of inaccessible or unreplicable equipment or recipes. And I think the main thing is that she really just is engaging. She expresses herself. She isn't self-indulgent like some of the other hosts are. And I just think that she really has a complete relevance to almost anyone who's just interested in good food.
Patrice, thank you so much for the call. Farmhouse Rules, she recommends. That reminds me, Michael, there was a reality show where people were trying to become the next food show TV star. Do we know what makes a good food TV show host?
I mean, it totally depends, and no offense to many of the graduates of that show, but not many of them went many places except Guy Fieri, who was the second winner of that show, and he's gone on
okay.
to become... He did quite okay. He just got a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
Guy Fieri, yeah, there's a kind of a controversial figure. It seems like people have a love-hate thing going with Guy Fieri. What do you think?
I think that we're approaching the renaissance of Guy Fieri. I think that he was the butt of the joke for a long time, and people are starting to recognize that he's just like, he's a fun, passionate guy. And yeah, I think that there's more goodwill for Guy Fieri right now than there was maybe 5 years ago.
Let's go back to our calls. John is with us near Prairie du Chien. John, hi.
Hello. Can you hear me okay?
Sure. What shows have you watched, John?
Oh, my all-time favorite has to be the original Japanese Iron Chef. That show was just fabulous. I learned more from that show than I did from the year in cooking school that I went to in 1972-73.
Wow. Okay. Wow. John, thanks a lot. Yeah, so Iron Chef was a big phenomenon, and it was ahead of the curve for a lot of these shows, it seems to me, Michael.
Oh, for sure, yeah. And then there was a U.S. adaptation that I don't think it's entirely dead. I think it comes back and forth on Food Network. I don't remember exactly, but yeah, it's been quite a consistent performer over the years.
And that's kind of another genre. It's a contest, but not for everyday schmoes. This is taking, and it, Beat Bobby Flay, I think, is in this category. It's taking people who are really good at this and putting them through the ringer.
Oh yeah. I mean, when you look at a show like that, I feel like it's definitely an inspiration for Top Chef, which has become the sort of prestige cooking competition in the United States.
John, thanks for the call. We'll go to KC in Monroe now. KC, hi.
Hey, real quick. When I was a kid, I used to watch a show called Yan Can Cook, and I don't think anyone else ever even mentioned the show, like, ever again.
But wrong. I watched With Jan with Stephen Jan on CBC. I could see it from Michigan. Where were you watching Stephen Jan, KC?
Oh, on the PBS back when I was a kid. Like,
okay.
Close to 20-some-odd years ago. But this guy would, like, literally cut up everything and look at the camera while he's cutting it up
yep.
and not even pay attention at all. Like, I want to see some more showmanship like that.
KC, thanks. Yeah, and I remember Stephen Jan just, like, you know, he'd measure out spices by just grabbing a handful of it and throwing it in. And he's right. Never looked away from the camera. Yeah, who do you like as a showman, Michael, in the shows these days?
Oh, my gosh, who is a showman? I mean, Gordon Ramsay is, like, a showman with his attitude. you don't see a lot of the chopping with dramatic flair anymore. I feel like people are shifting towards more of a utilitarian approach to cooking, and there's no, I mean, whatever, Emeril Lagasse is probably the one from the most recent memory with BAM, which inspired a NBC sitcom briefly that didn't last.
Thank you, Michael, so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
That's Michael O'Connell, senior writer at The Hollywood Reporter. He joins us today to talk about how food TV has captivated audiences, grown big time, a lot of shows on the market, still in the pipes. Still time for you to share your favorites or least favorites. If so, why do you watch them anyway? You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page.